Yes, two of us go.
Right, right. Okay, this is talking with Sebastian von Herner at Montreal, IAU, on 20 August 1979. Well, can you first tell me what your educational background was? And I know you worked on many things before you came into contact with radio astronomy. Can you just briefly describe those?
Yes, I jumped around in my working fields a few times, and what I originally studied is theoretical physics, and I somehow went into hydrodynamics and then met von Weizsäcker and worked with him in cosmic hydrodynamics, if you like, and we did a lot of work on turbulence and shock fronts at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And later on I went to stellar dynamics and started these n-body calculations just on a computer without any theoretical assumptions, just see what happens.
Right.
Which
institute is this now?
The n-body problem was then in Heidelberg. Originally I was at Göttingen.
Right.
And then this was at Heidelberg, and we had what you would now call a very slow computer, and I could only work over whole weekends, and in the course of several months got it done.
But somehow we had more time in those days too, I think, to do those sort of things. And how was it that you came in contact with radio astronomy then?
This came by surprise. I got a letter from Otto Struve, who was director, and he invited me to come for a year as a visitor. And I was a little amazed and wrote back to him that I thank him very much and consider it as an honor and a pleasure, but I should be honest and tell him that I have not the slightest idea about this field. And he wrote back, he is aware of that, because he knows my papers, and he invites me and I could do whatever I like. And then I wrote back, okay sir, I have warned you and now I accept it. And so I came, and I must say I fell in love with the place on first sight. It was love on first sight. When I saw Green Bank, met the people there, saw the spirit of the place, felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a little different. At this time, Green Bank was still in its very beginning.
Right. What year now did you come?
16.
1960.
And the only telescope which was there was an 85-foot,
right.
25-meter telescope.
Right.
85-1 it is now called. And
right.
At this time, it was the only one. And there were plans for bigger telescopes, but nothing was there. And so there was a lot of pioneering spirit of building things up, and nothing worked, and it was just a very good atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And do you attribute this to Struve's leadership, or was it the nature of the people on the staff, or what exactly?
Well, it was everything together. It was a new field, radio astronomy was, and it was a completely new place. Green Bank just had been selected, I don't know, and started 2 years before.
Right.
And Struve was a wonderful man. For this task, he was a little too old, because too many things went wrong, and it needed a younger man with more physical power, like Hieschen later
on. Right. Hieschen started in 62,
yeah.
I believe.
Struve was, I liked him very much, and all of us liked him. And, he mostly was very well balanced. He was one of the old school and old gentlemen, and very seldom have I seen him lose his temper. One occasion was a very funny reason. Someone from the business administration had just painted the Grote Riva telescope, which is our exhibition piece, had painted it in blue and red and shining colors without having asked Struve. And in the next staff meeting, Struve got so furious about it, it was ridiculous, and he shouted, and he said, "I want this observatory become famous by the brilliant papers you write, and not by the brilliant colors you use on the telescope."
Those colors have always struck me as being sort of nice.
Well, they're very nice, sure.
Yeah. But it's also, of course, very interesting to have the old traditional optical astronomer leading all these young radio astronomers.
Yes.
What was the reasoning behind?
Well, Struve was just a well-known person who had
was it to
influence.
Give credibility to
yes,
Green Bank?
And you needed influence at higher levels, NSF and so on, and so you wanted someone who is known,
right?
And also from whom you know that he can be a good leader. And if everything had gone okay, he would have been a very good leader.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble was that we had a big problem with 140 foot. I don't know whether you know about
I know many details, but you tell me about things that you were
well,
involved
the problem was that the thing was designed by one man and improved by another man. Finally, some firm agreed to build it, and when they were in the middle of building it, they discovered that, in their opinion, something was wrong with the design. And there was already the concrete building and pedestal finished. Right. And there were some thousand tons, not hundreds, thousand tons of steel lying around and getting rusty.
Right.
And the firm refused to continue. And now what do you do in this case? You build a commission, a committee,
yeah, right,
to investigate. Well, they investigated for years and nothing happened. And at this time, some people in the higher levels thought it might be a good idea to just call it a failure, close the whole place down and forget about it.
That would have been the end of Green Bank, or would it have been?
No, this no, would not have been Green Bank.
Telescope.
I mean, this whole thing would have been closed down and called a failure.
Just that telescope, you mean?
No, the whole place, Green Bank.
Oh, all of Green Bank. Okay.
All of Green Bank, yeah, just forget about it.
Right.
And what made the great difference was that the 300 foot was designed all in a hurry, and the condition was to make it with money where we didn't have to apply at higher, which we somehow could scratch together. So the engineers were told, make it for $800,000 and not a single one more, or it will not be built.
Mm-hmm.
So they made it for $800,000 and it became a very good telescope.
Right.
And from then on, interest in Green Bank awoke again, and all of a sudden the commission was forgotten, and there was money to redesign and rebuild the 140-foot, and that was finished.
I see.
And from then on, Green Bank was a good place.
Right, so the 300-foot saved the 140-foot.
Yes, 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 yes.
And who do you think should get the primary credit for the idea and the pushing of the 300-foot?
Well, I think you have to mention three names, and I do not know in which order. I just say Findlay, Vartum, and Heesen.
And what were their specific roles in the building of the 300-foot?
Well, just pushing it ahead, finding an engineer who could design it, as is what Ed Felton, and just speeding it up as much as they could, scratching the money together, and just getting it done, period. Yeah.
Were there any unique aspects of the 300-foot design that allowed it to be done?
Yes, the unique aspect was that it was done all in a hurry, that it was, for its size, extremely cheap, and that it really did work.
Right. But what were the engineering aspects that made it be able to be so cheap for its size?
Oh, well, one was a limitation that it is a transit telescope. It
right.
cannot move in azimuths, but only in declination. Now, that is a severe limitation. Then, these $800,000, for example, limited the height of the towers. Now, when you are limited in the height of the towers, you are limited in the amount of tilt
how
and declination.
Far south, yes.
So you couldn't look far enough south. Now, some ingenious fellow I've forgotten who it was later on discovered, if you just dig a hole in the ground, you can go further south, and that's what we did.
Right. It's easier to dig
then
a hole.
Then another
in
thing
south.
Was, which made it cheap, that we took a few risks. At this time, there was no possibility to really exactly calculate the stiffness and stability of a complicated structure. You had to make approximations. And because of that, engineers always used multiply by pi. Yeah.
Safety factors.
And if you do this on two levels, you have multiplied by 10 already. And that is the way the 140-foot was designed, heavily over-designed. And on the 300-foot, we made approximations, gave a little safety factor, not pi, and just built it. And then we were very afraid it would break down under the first snow.
Right.
And we had a army surplus, or Air Force surplus, jet engine, and we melted the snow
right.
away by blowing hot air at it.
Right.
And this took several years, and fortunately, in the same year when the jet engine broke down beyond repair, this was the first year when computer people had designed methods and better computers,
mm-hmm.
so that a complicated structure could be investigated, so you could believe the results. And then we found we just have to stiffen up, I don't know, 4 or 6 members, and then the thing would be good. That's what we did.
So the jet engine was used for how long? 4 or 5 years, you say?
I would say 3 years.
Yeah. But the real reason for it was that you were worried about the whole damn thing falling down.
Yes, and I mean, we have ice rain once in a while, and it can get 4-inch thick solid ice, and that is a heavy load.
Right.
We even once, over coffee break, Findlay suggested, couldn't we heat up the surface electrically and melt the stuff which comes down? And I thought that's a good idea, so I sat down and calculated it. And I found we would need 7 megawatts.
Right.
And I saw I made a mistake. And well, meanwhile, Finlay had done the same and came up with 5 megawatts.
Right.
So we gave up on that one.
The local power company wouldn't like that.
No.
Now, let's go back to the 140 foot.
Yeah.
What were the fundamental design problems, I mean, from a technical point of view?
The real problem is that it was designed at a time where computers were already available by engineers who either didn't know it or didn't believe it or didn't want it. So it was designed the good old-fashioned way, before the time of computers, a polar mount, where you move the telescope only around one axis.
Right.
While an alt-azimuth has to move around two axes in a complicated way, and well, but computers have been available
right.
at this time already.
Well, the Parkes telescope, of course, is an example. That was an analog computer.
No, Parkes did it first analog. They also didn't believe in computers. I don't understand it, because I was at the beginning of the computer field and so fascinated by it. And that was in the early 50s, around 1950 began the computer time. And it's for me, it is I can't understand it, period. And now we have a very silly design, which is a sail high up in the air, captures whatever comes in terms of wind and snow and all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very vulnerable to solar radiation and to temperature changes of all kinds, summer and winter also. And it could be much better. I mean, if an alt-azimuth is close to the ground, and it's much easier to
handle. Sure. But given that once they had chosen the polar mount, were there other basic faults that could have been done a lot better?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, at this time when the first telescopes were built, all of them, not the 140, but only, nobody had certain terms of short wavelengths. So, I mean, you know the story of Jodrell Bank, which was designed for 40 centimeter wavelengths,
right.
And right away 21 centimeter was discovered and they had a problem.
Right.
Arecibo was designed for the 21 centimeter line, and now it is working at a few centimeters.
Right.
And so on and so on. And the 140 foot again was designed, I've forgotten for what, I guess, for 6 centimeter or 10. And nobody knew at this time, and we couldn't blame them that short wavelengths would become so important. And now we are on our way to improve 140 foot, and
even
a lot
today,
of
20 years later, yes.
Yeah. For example, I have studied the pointing errors, which were much too large, and have localized where do they occur and from what reason. And partly it is solar radiation, partly summer and winter, and by spraying foam on some few parts. We have improved the pointing error by a factor of 3, which is a very good factor, and it was very
little.
You mean
a thermal insulation?
Thermal insulation, and we have put heating pads on the upper floor, so that also the summer-winter difference has become less.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step we're doing now is this telescope is not a homologous design, which means it deforms heavily under gravity when you tilt it. And this is the present limit of its accuracy. It is not the surface, it is the gravitational deformation.
Okay.
And my idea was first to study the deformation, and in the first order it is astigmatic, which is a simple type. So you just make a Cassegrain, a secondary Cassegrain mirror, and deform it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Balance it off.
And then you correct the deformation of the big one, and we have made an experimental design and had very good results. On the water vapor line, at 20 degree elevation, we have improved it by a factor between 2 and 3.
I see, great.
And that again is a good factor. And that was an experimental design. And the real one will be finished in half a year.
Let's go back now to the early 60s.
Yeah.
Like you say, in some sense it's a bit unfair to say that it should have been designed for shorter wavelengths. But in terms of, at that time, were there other design problems in the original design that were improved or...
Well, it is just a very over-designed heavy thing. I mean, something an engineer would make where he isn't really sure of what he should make, so he makes everything twice or three times as thick. And
just
then it
service.
Gets so heavy that you cannot roll it on bearings anymore, then you need a fluid bearing,
mm-hmm.
and so it is resting on an oil film. And well, all this makes it awkward and expensive.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was, when it was built, I guess $12 or $14 million at this time, a lot of money.
So it was an over design, you're saying?
Oh, really, heavily. Yeah. You see, the 300 foot was 800,000.
Yeah. No, this is an amazing contrast.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get involved so much in antenna construction and theory?
Oh, this was in the beginning when I came to NRAO. I got very interested in cosmology. That was something I had never touched before, found very exciting, and wanted to do a little work in cosmology. So I studied it. I found it is almost all theory, almost no observation. And after a little bit of study, I decided what we really need is not more theories. What we need is better observations. And that then again would mean special telescopes or bigger telescopes. And so I began by trying to design a special purpose telescope which could reach very far out into space, but for a very limited region of sky only.
And the cheapest possible thing to do the job.
This was a reflecting cross, a very large cross reflection antenna. And it turned out that as a one-purpose instrument, it would have been too expensive, and so we gave up on that.
The estimated cost in your publication was just shy of $1 million for the whole installation.
Yes.
500,000 for the
antenna.
And
when
so
the engineers went over it, it turned more out like 2 million. And then we had the feeling that 2 million for a single purpose isn't justified.
Because it can only look at the 1 degree strip of the zenith,
yes,
apparently.
Yes, yes, you're right.
But this was the first, of course, of many feasibility studies and so forth that you got into antenna design. And so this is what got you fascinated then in the whole idea of structures. And
yes, that's right. This was the first time I in my life touched engineering problems and structural problems, and I just got fascinated, and they looked so nice.
Were you part of the whole 140-foot analysis at that time?
No, not that. But we had then, under the leadership of Finlay, we had the LFST study, the largest feasible spherical telescope. And we started out with designing all kinds of very different telescope designs, all completely spherical, and with 200 meter, 600 feet diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And found out that they all turned out very expensive. So the question was not the largest feasible spherical telescope, but the largest fundable telescope. And then we cut it down to 100 meter and worked out a real design in detail and went to NSF for the money. And
what year now are you talking about?
This was a 300 foot or a 100 meter design, and I had this idea of homologous deformations meanwhile. So this means that let gravity work as it likes, but make it so that it deforms from one parabola to another parabola.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main idea.
But what year now did you ask for the money from NSF?
Oh, I don't, can't tell. It's a while ago. And
well, let's say relative to the Bond telescope, was this several years before the Bond telescope was built?
It could have been almost simultaneously.
So they had already adopted your idea for the homologous
Yes,
design.
The idea, yes, and we had a different method, but the idea is this of a homologous deformation.
Right.
And I think I developed this idea around 1963 and worked it out in detail between 64 and 5.
Now, you mentioned this size of 600 feet, and of course my mind immediately rings a bell with Sugar Grove. Were you profiting from their experience in these designs?
No. I would say the contrary, because they gave up, and this meant every big telescope is bad. Yeah.
So it hurt your chances for funding, but
yes.
But in terms of design of telescopes, did you learn?
We learned what we should not do.
Right.
Make movable panels.
That was the main trouble at Sugar Grove, would you say?
One of the main troubles.
Yeah. What else? I'd be interested in your opinions on.
They were not sure about wind forces and other things, and just again the old good old way, if you're uncertain you make it stiffer. And so they wound up, after having finished the foundation, they wound up with something upstairs which was too heavy for what they had downstairs. And then they made the mistake that they started to build the foundation before the telescope was finally designed.
Fundamental mistake, to say the least.
Yes.
What was the whole steering, of course, that was an Alta Azimuth telescope,
yeah.
So they didn't make that mistake anyway.
No, not again.
But was the idea on the rails? Was that
All right.
That would have worked all right.
Yeah, we are still working with rails.
Yeah.
We have now a 25-meter design, and that again is just moving on rails.
The millimeter telescope, yeah. You mean, yeah. But now, going back to the early 60s again, I know that you had a very early interest in the whole extraterrestrial intelligence idea.
Yes.
How did you get interested in that?
Oh, I just can't give you any day, because even as a boy looking at the stars, I would wonder when I heard that stars are like our sun and so on, well, would they have planets? Would there be life?
And I see.
This is an old boyhood dream already. Yeah.
Now, were you at that famous conference at Green Bank?
No, unfortunately, this was when I just had gone back to Heidelberg to think over whether I could come for good, and in this time this was.
And you went back to Heidelberg for a year or something,
yeah.
And then came back?
And then I found I just have to go back, and somehow had to convince my family that it could be done.
But there must have been talk then around Green Bank about some of these questions.
Can you tell me about these? When I was there the first time, Frank, this was exactly the time when Frank Drake made his project OSMA. So I wasn't involved in it, but I looked over his shoulder every day, and we discussed it over coffee break and got excited about every little peak which turned up. And
what was the attitude of the other staff members towards Project OSMA? Can you remember?
Oh, they were very, very interested in it.
There was no one that was saying, oh, this is a waste of time.
Well, someone might say so, but I mean, this you can say about any new project, that if it has no success, it will be a waste of time.
Well, but obviously this sort of thing is rather different than most other radio astronomy
projects. No, I do not remember any, let's say, fighting against him or making nasty remarks or anything of that sort. Later on, some people said he was going too much for publicity, which I think he should do, and which is right, because the public is interested. So I think there was nothing wrong.
But now you're getting into later years. In the late 60s, you mean, when you say later on, or you still mean?
Well, after this first OSMA drive, when it was published.
Once the publicity began, I see.
Yeah, it began right away. Newspaper interviews and all the rest.
But now, your paper, I think your first one was the one in Science, was it not?
Yeah, this was Search for Signals, and I tried to make up my mind what could be done and what might it look like, and the next paper was about general limits of space travel. At this time, I still had the idea that, or the prejudice, that space travel must be finished within a man's lifetime, and only recently I've changed my mind completely. I mean, why shouldn't it take generations if a whole colony goes in a mobile home?
Or send robots or something like this?
No, a whole colony in a mobile home. I mean,
right,
a few thousand people in a big place, and why shouldn't they?
Right. But in terms of your own thinking about this problem in those days, did you run into, what kind of attitudes did you run into when you talked to other astronomers about these ideas?
Well, I myself was very fascinated and very positive, and so, of course, I met people who didn't share this attitude and were hesitant or a little opposed. But at this time, there was no mention of spending big money on it. So there was, again, no
threats,
reason
yeah.
for a heavy argument against it. It was just, should I waste my time or not? And if I'm willing to do so okay with everybody else.
Yeah,
And some astronomers would sit back and consider all this as nonsense, but this was only, I would say, very few.
I think there's perhaps more today that say that.
Well,
if you
today,
say it's few, then.
Yeah, but the reason is not the project itself, but the money to be spent on it. And everybody is afraid that it's his money which is taken away.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of people, though, that think that still, even if there were no money, that it's a waste of time to be.
Yeah, but that's a personal decision of those who do it.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. And the telescope time spent on it is very small.
Oh, that's certainly true.
Up to now, that this is really, we haven't done much. We
right.
have just started a few, almost a dozen of very short tries on existing telescopes with existing equipment, so we haven't spent any money.
But one final question is that you worked in Germany through the 1950s, not as a radio astronomer, but then you were involved with the Bonn telescope, at least in a peripheral way.
Not in a direct way. I mean, right. I was in discussion with the colleagues, right. but not...
But what I'm getting at is, yeah. I mean, I'd be interested in your appraisal of radio astronomy in Germany
yeah.
vis-a-vis the U.S. in the late 50s and early 60s. There was this telescope at Stuttgart,
yes.
which it seems to me did not really produce very much
useful. No. This didn't do much.
What do you think are the basic reasons?
It's hard to tell, because at the same time there were telescopes in Holland, for example, of the same size, and
right.
they did produce more. Now, they had the better electronics, and maybe that more astronomers got interested in it. I think I cannot give much comment, since I wasn't involved.
Well, I thought maybe you knew more about it, since yeah. you were German originally.
Yeah, but what I really envy, there's one point where I feel envy for my German colleagues, and that is the way funding is done, and was done also in the early projects. You see the Effelsberg telescope, and again the new 30-meter millimeter wave telescope.
Being built in Spain now.
Yeah.
Yes.
All this is done that you work out a feasibility study and a rough cost estimate, and with this you go to your funding agency,
right
here, NSF. And on that early stage, where you haven't wasted much time on it, yeah, they tell you either forget about it, it's not what we want, or they tell you, under the conditions that the final design meets what you say now,
mm-hmm.
you will get the money. And then you go ahead and put all your effort into it, and you come up with something big, and if mm-hmm. it is what you promised before, then
right.
you have some money, go ahead and build it.
Right.
And there's nothing in the way anymore.
And what happens in the U.S.?
And here in the U.S., you first have to work out a final design. You cannot come with vague ideas, with a feasibility study. That's nothing worse. You have to work out a final design, almost down to the nuts and bolts. And this takes years and years of hard engineering. Then you go to NSF. And I'm very opposed to the system that they never tell no. They tell, oh, sorry, not this year.
Right, right.
And let me use a hard word, I think this is a way of cowards.
Yeah, yeah.
They have not the guts to say no. Yeah?
The bureaucrat approach. Yeah.
Yeah. They just shove it off to the next year, and
yeah.
to the next year, and to the next year, until you get tired.
Yeah.
Huh? And that's not the way to do it. There should, I mean, those who give the money should have also the guts to say no if they don't like it. And then they should say it on a very early stage, so you don't waste your time. And if you are told no at the beginning, that's okay, yeah.
Then you can work on something else.
Yeah, you do something else.
Do you think this has hurt U.S. Radio astronomy in particular?
Yes, sure. We have, not only we, for example, the NAROC group. In the early days, there was the NAROC group around MIT.
The New England Radio Astronomy Corporation.
And they wanted to build a big telescope in a dome.
Right.
And they had lots of engineers, of good people, working on that project for years. And now, meanwhile, it is clear that all that was wasted. Talent
yeah.
and money wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And someone should have made a decision very early to tell them yes or no.
Yeah.
And the same with us. You see, we had started out
You're talking about the millimeter.
Well, we went from
200 now.
Meter diameter down to 25 now, yeah? First from 200 to 100 meter.
Going back to your early
then
studies.
Then after
yeah.
we got several answers of this type, sorry, not this year, we worked out a 65-meter telescope for 3-millimeter wavelength, which I still think would have been a very good thing. Again, the answer was never a no.
Mm-hmm.
Then we said, okay, go to something smaller. So now we have made a 25-meter. It is sitting there for 3 years. Nobody knows. Yeah.
Good to 1-millimeter wavelength.
Yes, and we yes. hope that we will get funded before the size converges to zero.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Sebastian von Herner on 20 August 1979. This is now talking with Helen